Hey guys, this is Rob Paulson, and you're listening to the Geekcast Radio Network.
Hello, and welcome to episode 203 of The Cinema Geeks. I am one of your Cinema Geeks, Optimus Solo, and joining me today is none other than Movie Revolt Dan. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
Good, good. I had to call you Movie Revolt Dan since we're talking movies today. But obviously you have been doing a ton of work since our last record, or since our last like series of recordings in the comic book world. Do you want to just spend a couple minutes catching everybody up on what you've been up to before we get into why we're here today?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, yeah, you can find me on most stuff as Comic Concierge on TikTok and Facebook and things of that nature. If TikTok still exists as we're talking about this and it's not banned. But yeah, I mostly just talk about comics, reviews, all that good stuff, and you can find it there.
It's been impressive to see the content you've pumped out, the interaction that you've garnered through, especially what is it Instagram or TikTok that you get the most? Instagram you get the most?
Facebook, actually. I guess because I'm old, that's where I get the most. Facebook and Instagram, like, typically. But I tend to like TikTok the most because, like, Facebook is there's a lot of angry people.
But, you know. That's the internet right there for you. Yeah. So I haven't been doing a whole lot on the recording side of things since our last set of episodes, which was covering the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles series, was kind of the main thing that we did last. I was doing some episodes of the Geek Showcase, and it's been on a tiny bit of a hiatus as I've been watching a lot of cartoons recently and doing the written side of things, and then I'm going to transition that into some videos on the YouTube channel as well. I decided to do something probably ridiculous and attempt to watch as many cartoons from the 1980s as I possibly could.
Wow.
And not just watch like a couple episodes, but watch like every episode of these shows. And I decided to start with the ones that are the shortest. So like there's a few out there that only aired like one or three episodes. And currently I'm in the group that aired 13, which means it aired for one season on Saturday mornings. So that's been an interesting trek, and I think it'll be fun to do when I do the videos, because I learned a lot more about some of these cartoons than I ever knew, and it just sounded crazy enough that it was right up my alley. So that should be coming. The written versions of those are on the Geekcast Radio Network, and you can view those there. But I'll be doing that. I'll be getting back into some more top list on the channel as well. I still have some Star Trek crews that I need to rank, and a couple other things. So you can kind of check out the Geek Showcase for more content from me. But we decided to get back into the Cinema Geek vibe here and the rhythm. And we decided to do so by tackling a certain topic. We kind of went back and forth over the last... Every once in a while, we kind of do some brainstorming and think about different topics that we may want to cover, whether it be genres, whether it be directors, things of that nature. And Dan, this time we ended up in the world of Alfred Hitchcock. How did that happen? And what do you think of the journey that we're about to begin?
I don't even know how that happened. I think we just had a lot of different ideas. And I think it was one because it was kind of the most opposite of what we last said with like the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. There's a lot of his films that I have yet to see or have only seen once. And of course, like, you know, I've loved a lot of films that are inspired by him. So it makes sense to kind of go back to the original. Even the movie that we're talking about today, honestly, I never even heard about it before we discussed reviewing it. So it's exciting because I don't watch a lot of older movies, especially now. So it gives me an excuse to kind of go back and rectify that.
Yeah, there's so much time that I spend every year trying to watch like the current films and like the films that came out for that year that, outside of like the holiday classics or some things that you just kind of have somewhat on repeat every year or every so often. Like I don't go back a lot to watch older movies, and it also has the effect of I don't tend to dedicate a lot of time to go back to watch older movies that I have never seen. And that's one thing that really attracted me to the Hitchcock series is I believe if I'm correct, I've only seen two of his films. So I have a lot of blind spots. Like I've seen Vertigo and I've seen Rear Window, which I know that's what it, the, some of the ones that everybody's seen. So I was really interested to kind of get into this and watch a few of the other films as well. And also kind of go on this journey, like from somewhat of a chronological standpoint, to see like how his career progressed and evolved over time, because obviously this man directed like 396 movies or something like that. Yeah. Like it's just absolutely insane. Like we're starting at what's considered one of his earliest, which is actually his like 22nd or 24th film or something like that. Like,
yeah,
it's crazy.
I was going to say like when we started, I'm like, oh my God, is this like one of his first movies? And like, because considering how early it is and knowing like how long he was making movies, and like, no, it's like his 11th film or like something like that. So it's,
yeah, it's, I think crazy. it's his 11th or 12th sound film.
That's true. Yeah.
I think he had 10 or 11 or something like that of silent films before that. And so I guess you get to about 20, 25 films and people consider that like the beginning of your career. Which today would be a much different thing, I feel like. So we're going to be all over the different decades. We'll go ahead and kind of highlight which films we're going to cover on this retrospective. So it's going to be 10 episodes. We're going to cover 10 of, I guess, what you can consider probably his most well-known or well-respected films. If you go through like a lot of the, you know, essential Hitchcock collection of what films are regarded highest, I think we hit a majority of those. Obviously there's more, you can keep going because of how many films he did, but we tried to cap it off at just kind of 10, just to make it something that's doable for us. So, and we're covering four different decades, I believe, of his filmography. So this will be the only one that actually came out in the 1930s. So 39 Steps is the film that we're going to be covering today that came out in 1935. Then we have two from the 40s, which would be Notorious and Rope. And then we have a handful of the 50s, which would be Strangers on a Train, Dial M for Murder, Rear Window, Vertigo, and North by Northwest. And then we'll finish with the two from the 60s that we wanted to cover, which would be Psycho and The Birds. What do you think of that collection of 10 films? And kind of, are you more excited for one versus the other, or just kind of interested to see how they all stack up when you watch them kind of somewhat one after the other?
Yeah, I because some of those I have seen before. I've actually never saw The Birds, so I'm kind of interested in seeing that, because that's what I hear, I think, the most polarizing reaction. Because I know a lot of people love it, and a lot of people think it's really silly. So interested to seeing where I fall there. So the ones I have seen before are like Rear Window and like You, Vertigo, and I can't even think Psycho, of course, and then oddly saw Psycho, the remake, before the original, which is probably not the best way of doing it. So, but
I have heard. Oh, sorry to cut you off. I'll let you continue in a second. But I have heard that I listened to a few. I don't know. I had some time. I do a lot of driving nowadays for my job, going in between different places, and so I listened to a lot of podcasts. And I listened to some a podcast that did a review on the 39 Steps. And they made a lot of comparisons or connections, I guess, to North by Northwest. And having not seen that, I'm interested to, as we kind of go through that, once we get to that one, which is towards the end, to see like if these connections ring true that they kind of brought up and some of that. And it's another thing that we'll probably highlight as we kind of go through. There's a lot of, I guess you can call it like Hitchcock trademarks that people claim, you know, Hitchcockian things that occur. So I guess we're kind of starting somewhat early on to see like maybe some of the origins of that and see how well they kind of play through this set of 10 films, which would be something interesting to look for as well.
Yeah. I have seen North by Northwest, and I did get similar feelings. We can talk about it, like regarding how those connect, but it's also been years. I think probably like 10 years since I've last saw that movie, like one of the first Blu-rays I had. So it's been, a good amount of time.
And then we will probably end up this retrospective towards the, after we get done with Psycho and The Birds, we'll probably do a, I guess we can call it something, we'll come up with some clever name, but there'll be some type of an award episode where we kind of highlight what our favorite parts of the retrospective were, maybe some of the best performances, scenes, moments, you know, different things. We'll come up with a series of those types of things to kind of wrap everything up at the end as well. So you'll get 11 episodes in total if you're counting. So, anything else that you want to discuss or get out of the way before we get into the 39 Steps, Dan?
Oh, I think we can go right into it.
All right. Well, the 39 Steps is directed by Alfred Hitchcock. I guess we don't have to say that every episode. And it's a 1935 British spy thriller film. So this is going to be one of his British films. I guess they're somewhat, when you look at his filmography and someone that did as many films as he directed, it seems to have a natural way that they break it into segments. Like there's the silent films, and then I believe they usually do like the British films, and then there's more of the, I guess, mainstream, like Hollywood American films that will come later. So I guess this falls into the British section of that in the 1935 era here. And it's starring Robert Donat, which is, I believe, the correct way to say his name. They were having some fun with that on the podcast and calling him Donut. And I think they found like five or six different pronunciations, but I think it's Donat. And Madeline Carroll, and it's based on a 1915 novel, The 39 Steps by John, I want to say Buchan. That could be wrong as well. So what was your initial take on The 39 Steps and kind of just like your initial reactions as you watched it?
Yeah, as I mentioned, this is the first time I went into this. I wasn't sure what to expect whatsoever because, you know, I when I hear people talk about Hitchcock, you know, you hear a lot about North by Northwest, Vertigo. I don't hear a lot of people talk about 39 Steps, but interesting going back and seeing that Hitchcock called this his favorite film, and I didn't know that going into it, but looking back, I can kind of see why. But I really enjoyed this. It was interesting. Like, the thing that I thought about as I was watching it was that there was not a wasted moment, which sounds weird, but like, even for if like how we think about movies today, we think they're more, you know, they're fast paced, they're quicker than a movie then. But in a way, it like this, like every scene went directly to the next. Like, there was not a, like a wasted scene. Everything had purpose to it. It overall, like, it's pretty simplistic plot, although like most noirs, it gets a bit convoluted in how we get to point A to point B, and it's like a lot of conveniences here, of course. But in our main character has what like I like to call like the James Bond effect, where it seems like anytime he's around women, they just instantly fall in love with him and will do whatever they need to in order to help him. He's got that, you know, he's got that skill. But I found it really enjoyable. You see, like, some early aspects of what would make Hitchcock, some cool tricks. Like, there's a few camera tricks where, you know, like, these weird zoom outs that are, like, focused on the characters' faces. Like, in the early beginnings where we get them, like, silhouette, and then, like, with the background as they're moving through, they kind of give, like, a, I don't know, it's kind of a weird feeling. He doesn't do it a lot, but he does it early on, I think, to really just set the stage. But I really ended up enjoying it. I thought it was an effective kind of mystery, not knowing what's real, what's not. It kind of has, like, you could see how this would influence everything from something like Northwest to even something like the Bourne trilogy, where you have this person trying to work their way throughout a countryside, and, you know, it doesn't feel like it was made on a set. You feel like they actually did go to some locations. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I didn't know. I thought it was going to be more archaic and I think a bit more simplistic in its approach, considering, you know, when it was made, how early it was in his career. But I guess, you know, making 20 films before this, he learned a thing or two, and I was a fan. How about yourself?
Well, it was interesting because I went into this one. I'm going into this whole thing, like, outside of obviously the two films that I've seen, I'm going into all eight films with like a completely open mind. I'm ready to see like what the attraction is to it, what the big deal about him as a director is, because he's been probably one of the most successful directors ever. So I'm definitely going in very interested and intrigued by this. I was a little bit apprehensive going into this one, just because, number one, it's going the farthest back that we could go, or that we are going. So, like, we're all the way back in 1935. We're literally, next year would be the 90th anniversary of this movie, which is, like, insane. So I was wondering, like, going back 90 years, 89 years, I guess, at this point, how much that may be, like, a little bit jarring, just because I haven't been watching a lot of old movies recently.
Yeah.
So when you're watching all of the current stuff like nonstop, I was wondering if that would be like a little bit of a disconnect. And then also going into, you know, a British film and seeing what that exactly meant in that time period. Like, how much is a different is a British film in 1935 compared to an American film? I don't know. Like, I'm not, you know, educated enough in older filmmaking to like know if there's stark differences between that or different things. So I just wasn't really sure like what I was going to get into. And I've actually, I think we both watched this twice, just as luck would have it from a scheduling standpoint. And I actually just got done watching it the second time. And I enjoyed it the first time. I think I enjoyed it even more the second time. And I don't know why that is, because typically with a film like this, it's most of the enjoyment is figuring out the different tricks and the different, you know, mystery, quote unquote, elements of it. But even knowing how it was going to go and whatnot, I just was able to enjoy the film even more, I think, the second time. And one thing that you kind of alleged to or kind of hinted at, I 100% agree. Like, I'll equate it to baseball just because that's something else I know. A lot of times in a baseball game, right, you're watching and there's the occasional action. Like, there's the big hit or there's a play, and then there's downtime. There's like the time that you can go to the concession stand, or there's the time that you can have a conversation with somebody next to you, or just kind of enjoy the scenery, and then you can pay attention again like a minute later or 2 minutes later, whatever the case may be. That is not what you're going to do in this film. Like, I didn't find any downtime. Like, it is quick. I guess it's weird to say, because a lot of people would watch this and their reaction may be like it's slow because of, you know, the time period and how they film things and whatnot. But this film clocks in at an hour 26. And to me, it flies by. And
maybe,
go ahead.
Sorry. I mean, I was gonna say, maybe because now like every movie is 2.5 hours, and like it's like a movie that's this short just feels like it's like, oh wow, this is like a TV show episode, but
yeah,
in a good way. But
it was funny though, because the podcast I was listening to, that was one thing that they actually disagreed on. The one person said that they thought it flew by, and the other one thought it was kind of a slog and that it seemed like it took forever. And I just did not pick up on that. Like, the first time I watched it was, you know, I was taking everything in. The second time I watched it, it was as if I was remembering scenes from the first time, but I expected them to take longer. Like, I was like, oh yeah, that's this part. And then 2 minutes later, that part was over. And I was like, oh, I don't remember it being that quick. Like, I thought we spent more time in this area, or I thought we spent more time on this little sequence. And it's just like, boom, 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 boom. Like, they're literally not wasting any time going from A to B to C. Like, there is a lot of steps, like you said before, like there is a lot of, they would probably call it twists and turns. I don't know how twisty or turny it is, but there is a lot of different like segments as far as getting from, like you said, point A to point B, to kind of beat a dead horse there. But there's a lot of it. Like, I almost forgot how many different sequences there were. But the thing is, like, I didn't find any of them to be like the downtime. It wasn't like, oh, this is the sequence that there's going to be a bunch of dialogue and they're going to explain a bunch of stuff and I can kind of like somewhat pay attention. It was like, it was important stuff and it was action and it was happening at a rapid pace, I thought. So I kind of I really enjoyed that actually, and I wasn't expecting to see that as much. I really liked Robert Donat. I thought that he was a likable actor, a likable character, performance, whatever. So that kind of drew me, since I think he's in every scene. I don't think there's a scene without him, hardly, is there?
No, I mean, like, the opening scene, he's in it, but he, like, you don't even know he's
right,
the main character. Because at first, I just went in cold. I didn't know anything. I didn't know who was who. So it was like, you know, he's kind of just in the crowd. But yeah, I think he's in pretty much every scene. We see everything through his point of view, which is part of like the enjoyment, because you don't know, who's really on his side, who's really not. And some of the twists and stuff you can see coming, because of course by this time it's old hat,
right?
But it does keep you isolated in that way, which I thought was rather effective.
But I think when you have, like, you know, I'm just making this up, this is not like actual facts here, but when you have an 86 minute movie, and my guess is he's in at least 80 minutes of it, if not like 85 of it, like, it's important that person that you're having on screen that much is somebody that can carry it, and someone that is easy to watch and fun to watch. And so I think they did a great job with that. I don't know much about his career or what he did before or after. I know they specifically brought in both himself and Madeline Carroll, who plays one of the main females in this film, in an attempt to make this resonate more, I think, in for American crowds is something I read, because they wanted it to be successful in not just in Britain. I didn't read too much up on that, but I thought I read a snippet about that. So I don't know what their, you know, their background is, but they did specifically bring them in for a specific reason. And I just thought that they both did a really good job. I would actually be interested in watching him in something else. I would just have to do the research to find out what that is. Any other actors, actresses, performances that kind of stood out to you, or where do you want to go next?
Yeah, so it is. I think he was really good, and I was watching it. Like, I can't. I was like, he reminded me of someone. I couldn't really figure it out, but it was Cary Grant. Like, he has a very similar Cary Grant personality, which makes sense because, as you know, Cary Grant ends up working with Hitchcock later in his career. So that may just be the performance Hitchcock is looking for his characters. But yeah, I like you said, he was a standout. You do have like some of that classic, like, you know, you can tell a lot of these people came from the theater. So there's a lot of overacting, you know, a lot of like really big acting, which was, you know, more of the time. Madeline Carroll, I think, especially, like, she really dove into her role and was certainly like, playing for the backseats, as they say, but not in a bad way. I think it's fitting for the movie, but yeah. And even like some of like the farmer family, like, they felt very authentic to the time and place that, you know, how the, it's even if his wife magically falls in love with him, you know, he's got a, like I said, he's got the James Bond disease.
He didn't have a, the bar was low. Let's just say
that. Yeah, true. That's very true. He didn't have much competition. Yeah. So, but yeah, I thought overall all the performances were good. Like, it wasn't like you said, I think Robert Dene, his performance by far is what carries the movie literally. And then everyone else, you know, does their part. No, I don't think the way the movie is designed, you don't get a lot of other characters. You kind of, most of them come in and come out. Like, there's no overarching villain or anything like that. It's kind of just the situation that is what's propelling everything. So it's really hard in that time just for any really major actor to get their shine. I mean, you of course have, but I do think, like, even his relationship, his chemistry with Madeline Carroll was strong, and those scenes with them, like, running, being handcuffed, and, you know, like that could have not have been fun just to do. Like, they just look, you know, like it looked like they probably had to do that like 1,000 times, and they clearly were not faking those handcuffs. So
no, and I actually read something on, I don't know if it was IMDb or they've mentioned it in this podcast or whatever, but apparently, I don't know if it's true or not, but there's a lot of reports out there that Hitchcock actually handcuffed both of them together before their sequence with this, and like pretended to not know where the key was for like hours. So before they filmed this, so I think they were like well into the, like, I'm tired of being handcuffed to this person when they actually filmed.
So, yeah,
and they said they that she actually had bruises on her hands when they were all done from like the handcuffs.
I mean, that does sound like movie making back then. They were quick to abuse the actors, and I mean, if anything, that was kind of tame compared to some other stuff. But right. But yeah, they had that good like bitterness towards one another, where they like each other, but they also hate each other, which I feel like was the norm for any type of, you know, relationship during this. Of course, like the classic, like, hate each other at first and come together. But even like that, it wasn't like overt. It didn't get even cheesy for that day. It felt like they had a bit of a light touch to it. So
right, and I think part of what helped that is like they didn't really go anywhere with it.
Right? Yeah,
not to I don't know if you can spoil a 1935 film, but like the last scene, the last shot is like as close to, as they get to exploring that, and I think that was a nice touch. Like, they don't go too far with it, which I think helped a little bit. And before all of the much more educated and informed film people write us too many bad reviews, I should at least say that Donat, if I was looking for something else, he won an Academy Award. So
there you go.
He won an Academy Award for Goodbye, Mr. Chips in 1939. So that's me not knowing much about the 30s films. His rivals for Best Actor Award that year were Clark Gable for Gone with the Wind, Laurence Olivier for Wuthering Heights, James Stewart for Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, and Mickey Rooney for Babes in Arms.
Oh, I mean, the fact that he—I mean, that's a pretty crowded bunch right there. So,
right.
I've never read. I've heard of Goodbye, Mr. Chips, but I've never.
Yeah, I've never seen it. So apparently, he won that, and he was also nominated for a Best Actor Oscar in 1938 for a movie called The Citadel.
Yeah. Every time I hear that title, for some reason, I think it's a movie about a monkey, but it's not. It has nothing to do with a monkey. Mr. Chips just sounds like a name for a monkey.
Yeah, but I think you did point on something that I appreciated, which, regardless of how crazy they might have been or how overacting or different things like that, I think when you break it down into the different sequences, so like you basically have one sequence where he is interacting with the professor, I believe is what they call him, Professor yes. Jordan, in Professor Jordan's house, who's entertaining a bunch of people. So you have that sequence where he's with that. You have the sequence that you alluded to with the farmer and his wife. And then you have the sequence in the hotel with the I assume man and wife that are running the hotel.
Yeah.
And then obviously kind of going into that, you also have his sequences with Carol when they're kind of like on the run. But each of those other parts, like when you take the hotel folks and the farmer and couple and the professor and his family, like each one had kind of a little bit of a, I don't know, like just something to it that was fun to watch. Like they had the uniqueness and they had something that was like, oh, I can spend some time in this setting with this group of people because I'm finding them entertaining. You know, there is some humor thrown in a little bit with each group, but I found each of those like in a different way, kind of like a fun, it wasn't like one of them was worse or better than the other. It just like, oh, here's another fun like couple or group of people that we're going to interact with. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
And of course you have two different sequences in a auditorium type setting or stage type setting where you have the audience, which obviously you're not going to get like the one-on-one or like the real in-depth into any of those characters, but it's another sequence where you have a variety of people that are somewhat fun to watch and kind of see what they're going to say. So I thought each one of those different things kind of brought an element that was, again, helped it keep the pace and keep it entertaining and moving swiftly, because none of them were a letdown to me.
Yeah, and speaking of which, I think, like you mentioned, fun, I do think there's like some actual good comedy here. You know, that scene in the hotel, probably the best example of, you know, like it's almost felt like at times like a bit of like you could, if you were just walking on that scene, you think this was like a romantic comedy. You wouldn't necessarily mm-hmm. think it was a, you know, a whodunit chase film. But I think it was able to hit a lot of different grounds and do each of them rather effectively. So that certainly, I agree with that. And it also makes me think too, because you know, a lot of this movie is about like what's the enemy behind us? What's causing it? Isn't super clear. It's very like, you know, just this nebulous. Mm-hmm. Some, you know, people, there's some secret society, something of that nature.
Right.
But also makes me think if that was at all tied to like the time, because I know this is 1935. Of course, you know, you have mm-hmm. Germany doing what it's doing, and it's kind of spanning across the world. You know, think, you know, as we're in the brink, what, how many years and 6 years until World War II?
Right.
But there is always that fear of, you know, internal strife. You know, a lot of those countries that fell because of those within kind of fighting yeah. with Germany. And I wonder if like that was, it was never direct, but I do wonder if that was ever there, just like, you know, that idea that some of these, like mm-hmm. where this was coming from, because obviously you have this, is it this government, is it another government? It always made me wonder, like, is there anything meant as allegorical representation of what was happening and, you know, the fear that may have existed at the time, considering what was happening around the world? I don't know if that's just me looking into it and trying to see, but I'd wondered, just considering its time and place.
Yeah, that's definitely interesting take. And I do believe I read somewhere that also kind of alludes to one thing that apparently Hitchcock does throughout time. I don't know if it's necessarily one of his trademarks, but something that he does from time to time in some of his films. They mentioned that there's a plot that involves a pretty major point of the plot that he keeps, use the word nebulous, but like very vague or very like yeah. not fleshed out, not really like dissected. And I wonder if we'll see that in any of the other films we're covering, but I have read that that's something that he did a few different times where there's like whatever you want to call it, the MacGuffin or like the thing that is driving the plot, but then it's also really never, it's the movie's not about it at all.
Yeah.
Like it's a thing that's driving the plot, but the movie doesn't really care as much. Like, so this one's basically like plans for an airplane engine. Like, if you get down to it, and like, but that has nothing to do with the movie.
Like, who's after it? Like, who's really, you know, the what those plans are, what it can lead to. I mean, they're bad. Like, you can't get them. No one can learn about them. But like, who the other side of that is, and it, you know, it's always, it isn't. It's not about the details. It's just about this is just this is, you know, this is what's driving it, and we're, and let's go from there. Which I, again, I think that leads into maybe an issue with movies today. Not like, not to be one of like movies today aren't any good, but like I feel like people don't like that. There's often that like need for explanation, and like if they don't have that, you'll get like 1,000 YouTube videos about plot holes. When it's like, no, it's not a plot hole. It's just not explained, and that's okay.
Yeah, doesn't need to be. Did you see anything else that was, well, anything that you identified that was maybe like had a Hitchcock fingerprint to it that existed in this film that you know he's known for, or that you know you've seen in a couple of the other films you've seen from him?
Like I mentioned, like the relationship to North by Northwest, which has a lot of like foot chases, like a lot of these consistent long chases where we get that shot in the field, and because of course you have that classic scene in North by Northwest with the airplane. We don't get that here, but you at least get that like really pulled back shot where you see just you know, him running off, and it really staying consistently there. So I don't know, like shot wise, if it's similar to North by Northwest, but just the concept of that moving, or just like the constant, like you're never safe. Like no matter where he goes, there's someone there. And like, even when he thinks like, this is like, oh, I'm finally with an ally, that is not the case. So that reminded me of that as well, where there's always like that next step, like everywhere he goes, there's a new challenge that he has to try to overcome and get by and get away. It's just always, you know, he's on a bridge you have like that opening, not the opening, but the train station scene. And then he's on the train, and then we move from the train to the bridge. It's just that constant moving from one place to the next. All, you know, and no matter, like, these have to be like the best cops ever, because like the way they're able to like, you know, follow him from across the little, you know, the country is like rather impressive. But again, like that's what had me reminded me of North by Northwest, is just that constant movement from one place to the next. Which I think was a big part of why I think it worked for me.
I think another thing I read that is something that comes up from time to time in a Hitchcock film is having a main character that's, I believe most of the time male, that is kind of finding themselves in a situation where they're innocent, but on the run.
Yeah.
Or something of that nature, like in that realm where you're trying to like either clear your name, or you're trying to get away from something that you didn't necessarily do, or something like that. I've heard that that's something that comes up multiple times in his filmography. And then the other one was, there's always this like the Hitchcock blonde is like a thing, like a trope or whatever. And one of the articles I read on this film says that this is kind of the, I don't know if it's 100% the first, but they claim that this is the first one of those, or kind of like the foundation of what becomes that is Madeline Carroll in this film. So I don't know how many of the films we'll find that have the Hitchcock blonde in it, but I guess this is one of the original.
What do you think of, you know, of course, just Psycho at the top of my head and stuff like that. So I could see that for sure.
What about, obviously we're dealing with the technology of 1935, right? And the filmmaking mechanics that goes with that, and all, you know, especially for people that are used to watching newer films, did anything stand out to you that was interesting, or that kind of you weren't expecting, or just kind of you saw and took note, like a mental note of something that was like just something you didn't expect that you're seeing, that's like a sign of the fact that this is done in 1935?
One thing that caught me off, and I mentioned it in the beginning, was like, I don't even know how to properly describe it, but it's like we get the The focus is on the one character that she's kind of explaining what's happening. It's just her face and silhouette. Mm-hmm. And then it's over top of like a completely other scene. And, you know, that's, you know, happening. It's basically the back, you know, just a background or someplace else. And it made me wonder, like, how exactly at that, you know, that time there was no computers. Like, what was the methodology there? It wasn't anything super complex, but it did make me wonder, like, filming, basically having two scenes at the same time in a time and place where that wasn't physically possible. Like, interesting. Right. Like, how they must have had a splice to film in some way or something like that. It wasn't like a visual trick. It wasn't like she was standing someplace and they were trying to, you know, just it was something where the film was laid on top of each other or something of that nature. I'm not sure how they did it, but that's what that caught me off guard a little bit, was just like how they were able to accomplish that at that time.
There was one other sequence that I noticed. I don't know how many of the early sound films did this, but it definitely harkened back to like the silent films, because you see it a lot in silent films, was the they sped up a sequence of
pictures. Yeah.
So there's a time when he's running through the countryside or whatever, and the police are chasing him, and they definitely have it going at like, I don't know, 2.5 speed or something like that compared to one. And it was like very reminiscent of what you would see in the silent films.
Yeah. It wasn't like, you know, to the Benny Hill level, but it was certainly like, it was, you know, I didn't hear that music playing, but yeah, that's a good point about certainly you see a lot of those tricks that were utilized during that era. Kind of still being used here.
Yeah. And then this has nothing to do with the filming, but I did appreciate the 1935 helicopter.
Oh yeah. I didn't
it was like, what, that's a helicopter?
Yeah. I mean, that must have cost them so much money, because like those things were not cheap,
right,
back then, you know.
Apparently, you'll go ahead.
Yeah, because I say, like, I don't even remember when helicopters first, they couldn't have been that old at that time. So
they got one in there. So another thing that I did read up on is that Donat apparently had chronic asthma. So he struggled with any type of long take. So I don't know if that precluded them from doing any significant long takes in this film. I guess the one that stood out that they mentioned is the one where he's in a scene where he is on the run like he is most of the film, but then it ends with him being on stage and having to give a speech, I guess, in posing as somebody he is not. And I guess that was the one where if you kind of watch it, he may start looking like he's somewhat actually like he did just do a long run and is out of breath. So they said that he was able to kind of do that, which was probably about at the edge of what he could do from a long take standpoint as an actor. But I didn't notice that, obviously, or didn't think of it. It just made it more realistic to me because he was on the run always. So that was interesting. Anything else that you noticed about the film? I do have a couple more trivia things and some more statistical things about the film, but anything else that you kind of came away with after watching this one?
No, but you did mention that scene where, like, near the end, he's, like you said, he's basically gets misidentified as a speaker, and he kind of has to go off the fly. But again, that's also what had me thinking, like, that message that he's speaking, is it, you know, is that directed towards the audience in a different way? Like, is that, like, Hitchcock speaking about something else? Maybe not, like, more indirectly. Like, the thing that came to mind was something like The Great Dictator. Like, it wasn't exactly, like, but it had similar context, which, is, I don't know. Again, that might be me just superimposing that on it, just thinking of what was happening. But it kind of came out of nowhere, but, like, in a good way, because suddenly we're getting this long monologue, which is, I think, speaking to a grander point, how after, like, most of the film was more of this, like, thrilling, exciting chase, so that...
Right.
That it was very
good job with that too. I kind of liked how they played that, because it wasn't like it was completely scripted, so you believe that he was trying to make it up on the fly, but he was really sick. So it kind of added to his character and kind of like what he was able to pull off with his charisma and whatnot.
Yeah. So, he wasn't a secret agent, but he certainly had a lot of a lot of similar skills. Like I don't even know what his job was, but he certainly he could think on the fly.
Whoever says, I don't think we ever get to that point where they even go into that. It could be wrong.
No.
Without giving away anything, I know it's a 90-year-old movie, but without giving away, what did you think of the actual, I guess, the major hook or twist that is revealed in the end? Because on the first time I'm viewing this, I appreciated the journey, and I appreciated all the twists and turns and the redirections and the, you think this happens, but it didn't happen. And then it got to the end with, like, the, I guess what you would consider the main one, or the crux of the whole movie. And I was, at first, I almost had an anticlimactic, like, really, like, that's where we were going with this type thing. The first, I didn't have that reaction. The second one, I was fine with it. But what did you think of kind of the variety of twists and turns along the way? And then I guess the main one at the end.
It didn't really hit me that hard. Like, it wasn't one that was like, oh, you know, either way. It was kind of just, I guess I was just ready for it to end. It just felt like the natural conclusion. Like, it wasn't one too quick or anything like that. It was fine. It wasn't, at that point, like, it seemed like something else was going to happen, because that was the pattern. It was more so just, okay, well, here's this final nail, and then, you know, that happens.
And there is, like, in a lot of these films, I think you can probably even do this, like, when you're watching, you mentioned the Bourne films, or probably when you're watching Bond films, but there is some moments throughout the film that you do have to kind of just accept and move on from. Like, I'm thinking early on, like, if you really want to be, like, getting way too involved with it instead of just enjoying the ride, like, there's an early sequence where he is in a room with I believe her name was Annabelle. Annabelle Smith, he is the character's name, and he's in the room, and, you know, she has kind of alluded to him on what her role is in the story and kind of what information she has, and obviously people are out to get her, and I don't think it spoils anything that, like, she does not long for the movie, but it's interesting to me, like, anything you would watch, like, if you watch, like, mob movies or mafia base movies or anything like that, like, there's no chance he lives through that night.
Yeah.
Like, so it's like, there's some little things like that that you just have to just, like, bypass and just be like, just enjoy the ride and keep going. There's a couple other sequences that are similar that are like, well, why did that happen, or would that really happen? But, like, as long as you don't get caught up with that type of stuff and you're just, like, enjoying the journey, I think you're fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I will say, I do like how it does, like, kind of come back together, like, that opening sequence that goes on for a while, like, you're talking with the Mr. Computer, Mr. Memory, mm-hmm. How it does come back to that. And it does also leave you with a question of who exactly is behind this. And again, which makes me think, like, maybe they didn't want to say directly, but they wanted to, like, lead people a certain way. That's still it's not fully answered, but, like,
right,
and certainly connect the dots if you wanted to.
Oh, I remember the other one. The other one was when he is with the farmer and his wife, and they're sitting down at the table, and he has just read a paper. Like, there's a common theme of papers being, you know, at different sequences that he's, you know, obviously on the front page or somewhere on there is, like, the story of what he's running from and things of that nature. But I find it real interesting that he's reading that paper, and then it's time for dinner, and he sets it on the table so that it's face up. Like, you wouldn't have turned that so that's face down, so nobody could read that headline. So, like, different things like that I found were a little interesting. So going into a little bit of the statistics behind this one, it was, I don't know if it was a box office success, because it said it was, like, the 17th best film at the British box office that year, which doesn't seem like a resounding success, but maybe that was good for that time period. I'm not sure. Like, if something was, like, the 17th best nowadays, I don't know if that's considered, like, a success when it comes to box office. But from a, like, reception standpoint, from a critical response, obviously it's very well respected. I think it has, like, a 96% on Rotten Tomatoes, and it's on so many different lists, especially when it comes to British filmmaking and things of that nature, or when it comes into, like, the actual genre, when it comes into, like, thrillers or suspense noirs and things like that. So you could just do a Google search, and you'll find that it's probably on, like, 100 different lists that different institutes or publications have done. So definitely well received from that standpoint. I also wanted to go through a couple things of trivia. And it's kind of interesting that you mentioned it too, because you mentioned a couple different things about Bond or the Bourne identity or things of that nature. And according to one website I read, Ian Fleming actually was a huge fan of either the book or the movie or things like that. And he's quoted as saying that without Donat's character is named Richard Hannay. And Fleming said, with no Hannay, there would be no Bond. So apparently this specific character was a huge influence for Fleming to create the character of James Bond, is what I'm reading that as. I don't know how true that is, but that's at least one snippet that I got from there. You already mentioned that it's supposed to be one of, if not Hitchcock's favorite film, so I thought that was interesting as well. And Sigourney Weaver's mom is in this. Uncredited role, but it's one of the professor's daughters. So I thought that was interesting. I didn't know Sigourney Weaver had a mom that was in show business. So I guess like Hollywood, that happens quite a bit though. So anything else that you wanted to bring up about the 39 steps before we kind of close this one out?
No, I would say one thing that's kind of crazy is how this is actually in public domain, because they forgot to renew the copyright. So that's why it's on like so many free sites. It's like, I think I watched it on Tubi or one of those, like, you know, free movie sites. I'm like, why is this free? And it's because they've just forgot to renew the copyright, maybe, which makes me think maybe it wasn't the biggest hit, but I do think it's one that is well regarded by a lot of movie fans. So if you wanted to see it, you can see it for free. And although there are some, apparently there's, because of that, there are a lot of DVDs released of it that weren't in great quality, but the Criterion channel and Criterion did put out like an actual good copy of it. So if you're going to watch it, make sure you're watching a good version of it that's not like, you know, poorly made.
Right. Yeah, definitely you can get the Criterion Collection version. I was able to watch it on Max, which for some reason isn't called HBO anymore. But that's a different story. It's also mentioned in The Catcher in the Rye. I forgot to bring that up. It's in the book The Catcher in the Rye. They talk about the film. So that's interesting as well. So I think we started off on a good like first step here, Dan. Like I was worried about this first one especially. I'm feeling positive about it, and I think it's setting the tone for the rest of these 10 films. What do you think?
Yeah, I like this one as a good starting point, because it's like got a one foot in like the old, in the beginning of Hollywood, one foot in what's coming up, and it makes it kind of a little bit in the middle. So yeah, and like I said, it's one I didn't know anything about going into it. So I'm you know, some of the other ones obviously we'll get to are pretty famous. So it was good to get one that was maybe on the lesser known side before we get to those.
So in the wrap up show, I'm sure we'll be talking about like best actor, best actress, or supporting actor, supporting actress, things like that. Is anybody from this film have a chance to still be in the running for that by the time we watch 10 films? Or do you think like the amount of like critical acclaim that some of the films have that we're going to watch are going to like squeeze it out?
I mean, I do think, I can't want to call him Donat, but he says Donat. How's it?
It says Donat on the thing, unless I'm just being like super American and pronouncing it wrong. But I read a pronunciation and it was Donat or Donat.
Okay. Donat. Okay. Whatever, however you pronounce his name. Like, I feel like he certainly has. Like I said, he had a similar quality of like classic actors that I feel like he's going to be that template that we're going to go back to again and again. So. Yeah. I definitely think he has a chance. And like you said, maybe even Madeline Carroll, because if she is that, you know, setting the stage for the classic blonde for his films, maybe like this will be like, you know, the origin of a lot of what we'll see moving forward.
Right. There's a couple good lines in here, too. I like the quote about, it seems like it's been used a lot of different times, but where he says something along this is a complete like butchering of it, but something about like, there's 20,000 women on this island and I got to be chained to you. Like, I feel like that's like versions of that line have appeared in a multiple movies.
Yeah.
So I appreciated that as well. So an overall positive review here of the 39 steps. I think it's worth watching, especially if you're trying to go on this journey with us through Alfred Hitchcock's filmography. Like I said, next time we will be covering Notorious, I believe is the next one. And we'll see. That's another one that I'm going to go in completely blind. Dan, is that the same for you?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. I feel like a lot of those like noir films of that age, like I always like The Big Sleep and like all those. I'm like, I think I've seen it. I'm not sure, but I don't think I don't think I have. I think it's pretty brand first time I've watched it. If I watched it before, it'd be when I was like 10. So,
gotcha. All right, so if you want to keep up to date with anything that we're doing, like Dan said before, search out The Comic Concierge on all the different social media sites. He's basically on all of them, so that helps. And if you want to keep up with my YouTube channel, that is The Geek Showcase, or you can keep up with all things GeekCast Radio related by going to geekcastradio.com, where you can see all the different things the network puts out on a variety of geeky and pop culture subjects. Dan, specifically, if someone was wanting to get in touch with you on one of the social media sites, what's the best way to do that?
Yeah, I say just hit me up. I would think on, you know, any of the Blue Sky, you know, Threat, all of them, just at Comic Concierge. You search that, you should be able to find me.
Absolutely. And you can find me by searching out Optimus Solo. That does it for this episode of The Cinema Geeks. Tune in next time where we go one step further into the Alfred Hitchcock filmography.